Greetings, my name is Daniel Four, and thank you for tuning in. This talk will be on the foundations of the way in which I approach work with blood, family, ancestors for the purposes of healing and reconnection. For more information on my practice and my background, you can see ancestralmedicine.org. Yeah. So I want to provide a wide overview and then narrow in on the specific way in which I approach healing work with blood lineage ancestors. And then we'll have a little time for a question at the end. My broad stance is animist to the work. And my influences are actually kind of diverse. And in the way that I approach ancestor work, I'm not presuming to represent one established lineage of practice. So I have spent time training with pagan European ancestor practices and revival shamanic practices. My own blood ancestors are German, English, and Irish, mostly early settlers, colonists to this continent. Spent time in circle with a lot of Native North American ceremony, mostly Lakota and Native American church, but I don't presume to represent those ways and what I teach, but they've been an important influence for me. And work with Mongolian shaman teacher a bit, Sarangarl Odagon. And I'm an initiate in Ifa tradition, Yoruba tradition. So I've been a student of West African, specifically Yoruba culture, for over a decade now, and make trips to Nigeria to work with elders there. Having said that, it's still not what I'm presuming to do to represent even Yoruba culture in what I'm teaching with the ancestral repair work. It's something that I was teaching and involved with before my involvement with Ifa practice. I also have a PhD in psychology, so that's a little bit about my own personal background and the way it intersects the work. When I say I'm an animist, what I mean is that my worldview sees living humans as just one person, one kind of player, one kind of participant in a much wider field of relationships that include the not incarnate right now humans, the ancestors and the ghosts, and the other than humans that we can see, like animals and plants and stone people and rivers and mountains, and the other than humans that we can't necessarily see, like deities and nature spirits and all kinds of beings that are not only human. And so our job as grown-ups, if we want to be exemplary human beings, is to learn how to be our unique selves and also to relate well with this wider field of relationships. So my own life path and calling has evolved in a way that I've ended up specializing a bit in the relationship between living humans and the humans who are not physically incarnate right now, the ancestors, the dead, etc. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Broadly, the ancestors are not just including the humans who are related to us by blood. They can also include ancestors of spiritual lineage. If you practice a tradition that's not of your blood ancestry, they include ancestors of place or of the land where you live, which, of course, for a lot of folks don't include only their blood ancestors unless you're living in a place your people have been in for a long time. And they can include ancestors of vocation, of calling. Like if you're a dentist, the ancestral dentists are part of your spirit crew in some way. You're carrying on their legacy. And so respect to all those other kinds of ancestors, I find that the ancestors of blood lineage, even for folks who are adopted and don't know their blood family or have a really particularly unhealthy blood family that they've had to make strong boundaries with, even for those folks, blood ancestors have a strong influence. And this is true scientifically speaking as well. If you look at modern studies on epigenetics and transgenerational, intergenerational influence. And so focusing in specifically on our relationship with blood lineage ancestors, if you look at the types of rituals that people come at the ancestors with, you could real generally divide them into rituals of maintenance and rituals of repair. Rituals of, and it's similar with other living humans. So rituals of maintenance would include well, they're predicated on the assumption that the ancestors are already basically well and that we're in relationship with them. There's a sense that you might nourish or renew a relationship through giving offerings at a certain time of year, that you might call on their guidance or intervention in a time of crisis. Much like a close friendship that is active, that you're tending, the sense is that you're already current with them and it's a generally beneficial flow of energy. Rituals of repair kick in when one or both people involved are not well and need some kind of intervention, or the lines of communication have broken down over time. And so working predominantly with Americans, or at least people living in the United States, I found that a lot of folks have not been actively tending to relationship with their ancestors for a long time, over many generations, often, not always, but often enough, especially for, especially for white people, European ancestor people, there tends to be a really pronounced breakdown, sometimes for 1,000+ years, in the active veneration and relating with lineage ancestors during life. And so you can't just jump right to everything's cool. There's a need to have some kind of repair or healing intent with how we approach that work. Before I talk through the specific steps or method that I teach and move people through with how to do ancestral lineage repair work with blood ancestors, I want to back up for a moment and just give a few bits of what feel like core context or cross-cultural assumptions about the relationship between the living and the dead, because a lot of the folks that I encounter, they don't have any framework for ancestor reverence to begin with. And so there's a need to have a little bit of common ground from which to engage. So the four assumptions that I teach to and find to be pretty universal or close to it are that there's something that continues after death. There's some continuity of consciousness in some way. And that doesn't mean that the soul is just one thing. I actually have the sense and resonate more personally with the teachings found in a lot of different indigenous traditions that we're a convergence of different energies. We're not only one singular soul. And so that helps to resolve the more analytical part of our mind that would ask, well, what about reincarnation? And so it's a big topic, but a short answer is, sure, there's reincarnation. No, there's not reincarnation. It can be both and. And it can follow the bloodlines. It cannot follow the bloodlines. When we recognize that we're a composite of different kinds of soul energies that we experience as a singular identity, there's the possibility that those soul parts or aspects of what we are go in different directions or have a different experience after death. Some return, some remain available as ancestors. But something continues. Death is not the total cessation of consciousness and identity. Two, not all the dead are equally well. This is very basic, but it's also very important. If I say not all the living are equally well, that's not a real deep thought. Everybody gets that. And yet, sometimes there's this view that just dying causes you to become wise and kind and somehow well in spirit. And it's not how any tradition that I've studied views what happens after death. Death is a time of great opportunity, and it's a jarring, typically, even for folks who are prepared for it. But it doesn't make you automatically evolved and kind. And so when I step people through the ancestral healing work, I ask them to think of any given ancestor, any given ancestral lineage on a 1 to 10 scale. The higher, the better. So the 1 to 3 range are the dead who are quite troubled, toxic, really sometimes hateful, sometimes very fragmented, sometimes tangled up with other kinds of other than human energies that are not very kind. And people who really were immersed in addiction and abuse and hateful behaviors toward others sometimes can continue on after death in a kind of stuck energy. And the 4 to 6 range are the dead who are not necessarily toxic, but they're not really well and settled in spirit yet. And so it's the regular dysfunctional ghost. And the 7 to 10 range would be the what I would consider a true ancestor, someone who has not only recognized that they've passed, but they're also networked in with other wise, kind energies, ancestors, ideally, of their own lineage. And these are energies that you would feel safe at night if they were in your, if you're sleeping and they're in your house. You wouldn't be worried if they're around the kids. There's a fundamentally kind of beneficial, safe quality to them. Even if they're rowdy and have a lot of personality, they're still, you know, on the side of the good, so to speak. And the goal of the ancestral repair work is to have all of your lineage ancestors in that state, if they're not already. It's possible they're already all well, in which case no need for the repair work, just proceed right to maintenance of a relationship that's already quite available. So not all the dead are equally well. They run the full spectrum from completely dangerous, hateful, and toxic to fantastic, loving, kind, funny, beneficial, etc. Think of them as a mirror of the living human population in that way. A correlate assumption to that is that they change. So just because someone has died doesn't mean that they're going to stay stuck in the state that they were in at the time of death. Sometimes people who are quite harmful during life get it. And in getting it, they participate in making repairs around the things that they were harmful about during life. And that's true, of course, of the living. When people stop being a jerk and suddenly want to do a lot better, that happens. And it's really important to allow for that. It's quite important to allow for that with the dead as well. Otherwise, we freeze them in a perception of how they were during life in a way that closes down the dynamic, changing nature of the relationship. And that can be tough when we have unresolved pain with people who have passed. And they do change and they work it out. And if we're not open-hearted and staying current with the possibility that they can change, then we shut down the growth that's and forgiveness that's possible in the relationship. I'm not saying they automatically change, but they can. It's important to allow for that. Another key assumption is that communication is possible between the living and the dead. And not only is it possible, it's actually kind of common and natural and not that difficult. I say that with respect to folks who may struggle either with making that contact or feeling that it's easy or natural for them, or who struggle with a lot of doubt. So it's not that there are not challenges at times in having a sense of connection that you can really trust with the ancestors. But I do see it as a very human capacity. I see it as something that almost anyone who's sincere about it can learn. And I see it as, it's not an inherently spiritual thing in the sense of being unusual or making a person special. It's quite common. And I see the reclaiming of that capacity to communicate with them as being a repair of cultural damage from ways that we weren't supported to navigate those relationships to begin with. And the communication can be initiated from either side. They can come to us in dreams, through waking events, through synchronicities, through dramatic things like flipping the car so they knock you out and can have a conversation with you when you're out, or just through smaller events where they get your attention. And the communication can be helpful or harmful. It's like communication with the living. If I say communication between living humans is possible and it can be initiated from either side, well, that's kind of obvious. So the ancestors are just people. They're just people who are not physically incarnate people right now. So the same principles apply to communication between us and them. a final assumption that's important with them as a big kind of overview point is that the level of impact and influence between us and them, between the living and the dead, specifically blood lineage ancestors, is really significant. It's substantial. And that influence can be helpful or harmful. It can be conscious or unconscious. Just because we're not conscious of how our ancestors are impacting us doesn't mean that their impact is automatically going to be harmful. I don't want to have a fear-based teaching that implies that everyone needs to focus on ancestor reverence. Having said that, if the influence from them to you is non-helpful, typically just because they're in an unwell state themselves, not because, in most cases, not because they have any bad intent, then when the influence is unconscious, we don't have any leverage over it. We can't do anything about it because we're not recognizing that it's even happening. And so the advantage, of course, of bringing it more conscious is that we can engage in some boundary setting or maybe some healing work to shift the energy up a bit. The way in which the influence can be unconscious but helpful, I think that's actually quite common. I think a lot of folks that have a successful life, good fortune, prosperity, good health, happy relationships, are enjoying a lot of ancestral protection and blessing and positive inheritance. They just don't have a framework to say thanks about it. And, you know, it's okay. I mean, it's better, I think, if people can recognize and give respect, but even if they can't, I think the ancestors mostly want to see their continuation and children be successful and well. So to recap, something continues after we die. Not all the dead are equally well. They change their state. We can communicate with them and vice versa. And we impact each other quite a lot. And it's possible to bring that more conscious. I will say that when the impact is unhelpful, it can include things like premature death, illness, mental, emotional illness as well, unsuccessful relationships, lack of prosperity, just confusion about your path and your identity, feeling of stuckness. A lot of, you know, I'm speaking also, I'm a licensed therapist, doctor of psychology, and I do have the view, and I'm like a grounded person from Ohio, and I like science. I'm not way out there with the spiritual stuff. It's actually a little bit annoying to me, but I do have the view that the ancestors, that a lot of the trouble we see as mental and emotional illness is intergenerational in nature. It's inherited pain, unmetabolized pain, and sometimes direct ghosty interference from the dead in our lineages who are not yet well. And I found in the last 12, 13 years of guiding this work for others a good amount, that when folks really clear up their ancestral lineages and they're in good shape and they're backing the person, that that really contributes to good fortune and also a bit better mental, emotional health and body health. So yeah, the influence is significant. I'll say that. So returning to the specific topic in the larger umbrella of the ancestors, the human dead, returning to the specific topic of how do you safely and effectively engage your blood lineage ancestors, especially when you sense there may be a need for some type of repair in the relationship, either because you just know they're kind of a mess or because you just haven't engaged. And so there's a need to approach with some caution because you're not sure what you're going to find. So let me talk through the five steps of the ancestral lineage repair cycle, I guess, as I've come to call it, that I teach in the trainings I guide and is featured in the book that's coming out. And so I do a lot of session work around this and just train some people in this work. So the first of the five steps excuse me, is, yeah, one sec, is to assess without judgment, without trying to contact them, without trying to heal or change anything. Just assess what kind of condition your ancestors are in right now in the present. If you're listening to this, you're alive and you have ancestors. And so how are they? The way that I think of your ancestors, for the sake of making it less totally open-ended, is four primary lineages. So your two biological grandmothers and your two biological grandfathers, and the lineage of women before your grandmothers and men before your grandfathers. Of course, you have 8, 16, etc. lineages, and each one is its own energetic system on back through time. You could look at 7 generations, but then you have to keep track of 254 different lineages, which is more than most people really want to work with or know about. So I find that starting with 4, 2 women, 2 men, 2 male, 2 female lineages, rather, is plenty. And some folks do go on to focus on 8 lineages, but it's a bit of a specialized thing to do it that thoroughly. So looking at those 4 lineages, with each one, the question is, how are you doing in spirit, in the present, on that 1 to 10 scale? And the recent ones may be in one condition, the older ones may be in a different condition. And then the other question that I invite people to look at is, how are you being impacted by these ones? How strongly are they affecting your life in the present? And so if you observe that a lineage is well in spirit and already impacting you, but you haven't really dropped in with them before, it's a good time to greet them if they're truly well in spirit as an energetic system. If you find that they're not well and they're impacting you strongly, that's important information. It's a good time to respectfully set a boundary with them so that they're anywhere in the universe except for inside, you know, your personal space and field of energy, so they're not drawing on your energy unhelpfully. And then start to ask, well, what do I need to do to bring some healing to this lineage of my people? And so that, yeah, so the first step includes assessing what's already going on. And that's me stepping others through doing it. It's not my style of working to be like, hey, your grandmother tells me this or that. I find that, again, that most people are able to drop in and get a sense of their own ancestors. And that first step completes by deciding which lineage would be where you're going to focus the work. And so the second of the 5 steps, let's say you decide through your discernment that you're going to give attention to your father's 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 father's, etc. lineage, because that's where the work's needed. That's where you're drawn to focus. Then the next step is to go as far back in spirit through visioning, intuitive practice, to connect with a much older ancestor on that lineage who is able to hold down the energy of an ancestral guide or teacher. So someone who's like a 8 or above on that 1 to 10 scale. And the sense here is that that is the last one when the lineage was really intact and well unto itself. You're going however far back the dysfunction reaches, because it's probably not more than a few thousand years, and it could be much less. But speaking as someone from European lineages, a lot of the earliest layers of damage from colonialism were already set in motion 1,500 years ago. And sometimes less far into the past, but sometimes even further. And so if you need to go back 3,000 years to connect with a grandfather who during life was an animist, had a relational view of the spirits and the natural world, and so in that way was conditioning himself to be available as an ancestor after death, and was preparing for the reality of being part of a lineage. And however far back you need to go, the second step is to connect with the last ancestor who's deeply well and well with the ones before them, so that you don't really need to go farther back because they're functioning as a group or a collective energy. It's one of the indicators of ancestral health is that the dead who are quite well in spirit tend to have access to group consciousness. They're able to function as a lineage or as a team. And the dead who are not yet well tend to present as a bit more isolated. And so in that second step, you're also getting to know what are some of the blessings and gifts of this lineage that have been obscured and have not been consciously transmitted, but have been a kind of hidden or secret transmission in the, or unconscious transmission through the blood and bones. And the second step completes when you start to turn your attention to the lineage between you and these typically more ancient ancestors. And that includes holding the lineage between you and them in a sense of prayer and wrapping that span of the lineage between you and them in healing, kindness, and containment. The third and fourth steps are about how do you actually heal what's between you and these ancient well ones. And those steps are where the greater risk or edginess in this work comes in, because the method calls for letting the ancestors themselves, the well ones, entirely guide that process. But there is a need as the human catalyst for the work to have some conceptual map for it and to have some sense for the possible dangers, because you're intending change at that point. I mean, you start with the third step by seeking to just understand what went wrong. How did things get off track between the ancient ones and the recent times? What are the older roots of the troubles that show up in the form of your parents' or grandparents' dysfunction? And what are the blessings that those troubles obscured? And once you have some understanding of what the troubles are, and the older ancestors have agreed that they're willing to bring their healing to the lineage, then the focus is on getting the lineage well, meaning receiving the ancestors who have not yet been received, from the past toward the present. And so we work with the older span of the lineage before the recent ones. So in this example of a grandfather from 2,000 years ago in, let's say, pre-Roman southern Britain, the work would be to make sure that the men who came after him, before the first Christians on the line, are well and received into the lineage. And then they would be receiving the early Christians into the lineage. And after that, the ones who lived in what we would think of as the Middle Ages or, that period in Europe, up till eventually the time when the first people on that lineage crossed the Atlantic. And there, it's my father's lineage, let's say, pivoting the story a little to keep it personal. The first four ancestors came in the 1740s. And so that's when I first pick up names in my genealogy research. And so that's a turning point from the third to the fourth step, because you're working with remembered names. So the fourth step is to work with the ones who are known by name. And the process isn't that different, except that when you get to the recent dead, like your deceased father, grandfather, etc., you're slowing down to allow for the emotional impact of the work. Of course, work with the older ones can also be impactful, because you're seeing the ways that colonialism, racism, sexism, patriarchy, all the different kinds of human toxicity impacted your specific people, or the ways in which they inflicted those troubles on others. And that can crack open the heart in a good way. And can be a source of the metabolizing of stored or blocked or underexpressed grief as part of how the ancestors themselves become well. But really, there's a lot of topics that an hour talk doesn't lend itself to totally unpackaging, but the short version of how the ancestors along the lineage become well is that they're received by the well ones before them and invited into the lineage in some way. And that can look a lot of ways. It can call for different kinds of ritual things to happen. But the well ancestors are the ones who guide the work. And the basic intent is that all the ones who came after them on the line, who have not yet been welcomed, are gradually welcomed, bit by bit, from the past toward the present. So that in this example, if my father's father has passed, let's say, I would not seek to receive or to see him be received by the ancestors until I know that his father is well, my great-grandfather. And we wouldn't approach him in spirit until his father is well. And so it's the older, more ancient grandfathers leading that process, and they're bringing their healing and connectivity systematically along the lineage until the recent ones have been received. And when the most recently deceased person along the lineage of focus is well, the fifth of the five steps in the repair work is to ground the blessings of that lineage in your body, in your present tense reality, in your relationships with your living family, and to be a prism or a channel, channel is a dramatic word, but to be a focal point through which the blessings of your ancestral lineages reach the living and gently reorganize your own body level genetic inheritance from them. Because when they're well in spirit, it's actually not that out there of a thing to ask them to nicely optimize or reorganize your epigenetic inheritance from them, your body level imprint of how their lineage lives in you and shapes your physical form. And so at that point, the lineage from the recent ones all the way back to ancient times is restored, it's healed, it's repaired. And that doesn't mean the relationship ends. It means it can begin in a way that is reflective of how it ideally would be to begin with. Meaning not all screwed up from 1,000+ years of colonialism, or depending on your specific ancestry, from histories of genocide around slavery, or the colonization of the Americas from really ill-behaved Europeans and others. And so whatever the ancestral pain that you have inherited culturally, it's not as if that suddenly is transformed, but what happens is that your ancestors, as they live in the present, once each of your lineages becomes well in spirit, can your ancestors are available for a new kind of relationship, because they didn't stop existing just because they died. And so once any given lineage is well, the basic approach is to make sure your other three lineages are well. When all three, or when all four of your main bloodlines are on the level, like 7 or above in the scale, meaning that they're not in need of healing exactly, they're more like, let's be in relationship, then that's great to do that. And there are some completion steps in the repair work that are about harmonizing those different lineages within your own heart, within your life, and so that they sit well in your sense of self. And at that point, if you work through the process and know that your people are well in spirit, not just the recent ones, you've repaired an important aspect of the damage culturally that a lot of us are experiencing because of how we're raised or not raised. And so, yeah, that's what I've been up to for the last decade or more. and it keeps me busy. And I would welcome questions in the chat. I could talk and talk, but let me say just that for now. There's a question, can I talk more on inherited pain that hasn't gone away even when the lineages are healed? Yeah, sure. I mean, we live in a culture and a society that's sexist and racist and has not, speaking as an American now, has not faced the dual genocides of African slavery and Native colonization of Native lands that the country is founded on. So we're in a system that has a lot of unacknowledged shadow and pain, and there's a lot of harmful relating ongoing with people of diverse gender identities or sexual orientations, or a lot of shaming around sex, sexuality. And so there's plenty of fresh pain being generated. And the ancestors, I think, want to see that go in a better way, but they're only one part of that equation. I actually think that a lot of the issues that we would think of when we think of social and earth justice work are unmetabolized intergenerational pain from the ancestors. They're inherited, unresolved issues. And I think in that sense, the ancestors really want to be part of the fix, the ones who are well. And, but yeah, there's 1,001 ways to still hurt even when your ancestors are well. But I think that there's less hurting alone when you know that they have your back. And so it's a pain when we're alone is kind of the worst. And it's hard, it's less bearable when we also feel really alone. And so when our ancestors are with us, they love us, we know them, we feel close with them, I think a lot of what is super hard is a bit more bearable. Yeah. So that's what comes to mind. Thanks, Gita. Yeah. Others have questions, it's welcome. I think I'm going to favor the chat for the questions, if possible. Yeah. Let's see, what are some common things that come up here? One thing I want to underscore, for people who have the sense that your family is just a wreck and a source of miserable childhood trauma that you've invested half of your income to try to heal through therapy, and just like a source of real disappointment in a profound way, I have found that ancestral repair work can be especially good when your family is disappointing and painful to you. Not because it is going to cause your family to have a personality transplant and suddenly see you and support you, but because when your family is not very kind or skillful in loving you, that can functionally sever you from what's an appreciation of what's good and beautiful and worthwhile about your own ancestral inheritance. And that reclaiming that, touching back in, even if it means going to much older ancestors to start with, touching back in with what's beneficial about your own body and blood can be an antidote to feeling ashamed about who you are, also culturally. And the ancestors are allies in having enough psychological resilience to participate in cultural healing. If you're a guy, if you're white, if you're American, if you have money, if you're Christian, if you, whatever your category of respective privilege is, there can be a psychological disincentive to actually participate in cultural healing because of how edgy and uncomfortable and messy on a heart level, and how it's challenging to look at different kinds of privilege. But it has been my experience personally and with others that when you're able to relate with your own ancestors, that sure, there might be a very small demographic of people who would take that in a really weird pride kind of direction, but I don't even think that those people are in touch with their ancestors. They're just being strange racists. And way more commonly, seeing the ways in which your own people have suffered and are still beautiful and still available that's a resource. That's a source of resilience for engaging in cultural healing work as well. So if you're, in other words, if your ancestors were, let's say, slave owners, I don't have the view personally that just disowning all your ancestors is really the most transformative move there. I'm not saying you just dive into conversation with the ones who may be quite troubled in spirit, but there's a reckoning that comes through being in relationship with them. I'm going to pivot to a question here. Someone's asking about the fine line between doing our own work and taking responsibility for the work of others. How do you sort through the boundaries of who's doing whose work? I think that my principle with it is get well with your own specific blood ancestors. And don't bring a lot of political agenda or activist agenda to them, because it's a very different set of rules when you're doing ritual and actually seeking to relate with the dead. There's a need to follow their lead a bit with it. And so come into relationship with them. Listen, as you would with, I work with a lot of white people, being a white guy myself. And so there's sometimes white people who are spiritual seekers idealize Native people, which is mostly unhelpful. And the way in which a white person might approach a Native elder, not that all white people have good etiquette around it, but a lot of white people may be like, oh, respected elder. A lot of people would get that there is some kind of deference and respect that's appropriate. So you bring that same respect to your own ancestors, your own elders, because they are also the ones who are truly well in spirit, which might require going back again a bit in time. The ones who are truly well, the older ones, they are essentially indigenous elders. And I'm talking indigenous in the sense of being rooted in a sense of place. I'm talking about tribal Europe pre-colonization by Rome and Christianity. And so there's a benefit in approaching our wise and loving ancestors as real sources of wisdom, that it's culturally appropriate and connective to draw on those sources of wisdom. And so once people are really in touch with their own four main lineages, that's what I consider a baseline for really taking some inventory around your blood story and family, then it's my sense that they'll guide you on what your particular role is in the larger cultural healing that's needed. Because there's 10,000 different ways to participate in addressing the current trouble. And the current trouble, speaking as an American here in early 2017, the current trouble is just the most recent permutation and outer unpleasant face of a much older kind of trouble that especially non-white people have been well aware of, having lived it for many centuries here. And that's not to minimize the level of real cultural healing that's needed, but it's not a new thing. It didn't come out of nowhere. And so sink in with your own ancestors. They'll guide you about what your role is in addressing it. If you're not living your own unique purpose here, you're at risk of becoming annoying to others. And it's really annoying and even more devastating as a critique is not effective. You're at risk of becoming a not effective activist. And so it's effective for the world for you to be yourself in a really authentic way. It's good medicine for people. It will lead you to your source of greatest service and power. So if you're serious about helping, you need to be yourself specifically. And the ancestors are good allies in helping to discern how to do that even more effectively. Other questions? Anybody want to type anything? Try to think what else feels important here. The forms in which I'm very excited. We had a retreat in California this last month where the first group of trainees in this work were graduated. It was a touching moment. I walked around the circle and shook everybody's hand and looked them in the eye, 11 people. And I'm like, you have my blessing to guide this work for others. And man, some part of me relaxed a little bit because I've been carrying it and feeling the relevance of the work. And so to choose to trust others to carry it was a risk for me, and it's been really lovely, and I feel really happy about the 11 trainees, and I'm really happy that there are people of African and South Asian and Native and, you know, Mexican, all different ancestries, backgrounds, or not all different, but diverse enough for a group of 11, and also not all heterosexual, not all cisgender, like a diverse group, which brings me a lot of happiness because there are populations that are just never going to trust me, and that's okay. And so I really feel passionate that whoever you are, it's good to love your ancestors and to find your way into that and to not let the cultural damage that you may have inherited or grown up in sever you from your connection with what's good about your people. And for folks that are drawn to indigenous spirituality and wisdom, of course, I meet a lot of European ancestored people who are drawn to such things in my line of work, you know, myself included. There's a risk if we don't engage and love our own blood ancestors a bit first, there's a risk of being off-putting, awkward white person around less white people who have relatively more intact traditions, who are typically scrambling to try to revive or nourish along what is left of the traditions because of the damage of colonialism. And so we're not always super excited to transmit them to awkward, not worked through white people. And so I, in saying that, I'm not at all saying that there can't be really robust, excellent, high integrity cultural sharing and participation in all different kinds of lineages, but that really loving yourself and knowing your own ancestors and knowing where you stand culturally and your respective kinds of privilege is going to cause you to be less off-putting and more grounded and less of a like needy, ghosty white person. So it's good. It's good in that way. And I found that in the time I've been in Nigeria, that knowing and loving like who I am helps me to just be able to relax on the front porch and sip gin and hang out and not be neurotic about it. So so I think it's good cultural medicine in that way too. And getting well with your people, with your ancestors, is useful when you die, because we're going to die, of course, and it's good to have met your people so that when you die, you know that there's a waiting crew there and that they're in good shape and that you feel good about them. Because sometimes people hang on and hang on. I don't even know how to estimate the probably billions of dollars that are spent each year from people who are digging in, unwilling to die because they're afraid of meeting with their family. Now, they might not articulate it that way, but I think a lot of people unconsciously are like, wow, if it's a kumbaya, I don't want it. My people are a mess. I don't like them. They don't like me, whatever it is. And sometimes it's true that their people are a mess. Sometimes they're just freaked out because they don't have a framework for it. But when it gets like that, it's very sad. And so that's avoidable by just getting to know your ancestors while you're here. I was talking to someone today who was very much like, Daniel, I don't want to be a ghost when I die. I'm like, you got to help me not become a ghost. I didn't mean to laugh. Like, it wasn't, it's not funny, but it's a really legitimate concern. And so one of the ways we make sure we don't get stuck and all convoluted when we die is we kind of do a trial death and we work it out and get to know the path between here and there while we're alive. We practice it. And there's a question from Chris. Moved about the piece about authentic purpose and loving lineage. Can I talk about how grief plays into clearing that space? Yeah, well, we just had here in Asheville, I live in Asheville, North Carolina, I just guided a grief ritual for 18 other people on Sunday and still cracked open from it. It's good. It's a little awful, but good. And but grief is like that. And there's a lot to say about grief. We did talk about it a few months ago. It's on the site if it's helpful for people. But briefly, I think a lot of our grief is ancestral or intergenerational. And a lot of it is longing in this really awful and necessary way for a healthy culture where there's like kind and safe touch, where there's an ability to see one another on a soul level. When we don't have really specific, skillful witnessing of one another, some part of our sense of self is weakened or withers even without being seen. There are some people I work with, I feel like I'm decent at seeing people. Some people I work with, and I'll reflect things that to me seem somewhat obvious, maybe a little bit intuitive. And it's just really impactful because people haven't had the experience of being seen on a soul level, which is totally, totally sad. And so we rely on, we require mirroring through all stages of life. And the ancestors, the older ones, can give a kind of mirroring that is hard to get otherwise. I hang out with living elders in Nigeria. I chit-chat with my teacher on Facebook. I've spent time some with native elders. And it's a funny thing. It's sort of dumb, but it's sort of human, that when I see them, I'm still aware visually and culturally of difference. And those relationships work on so many levels. And also there's something precious about seeing embodied earth wisdom in my own form or cultural ancestry. So I get all emotional when I'm watching Vikings, which is cool. I mean, it's not to idealize Norse culture because they're a little out of balance themselves, but love the haircuts, love the tribal like awesomeness of it, and how a lot of the rituals remind me of time in Nigeria. And I'm like, yeah, these are some of my people. Yeah. And really having a dorky but sacred sense of mirroring watching Vikings. And it's because we long for real elders and grown-ups. And it's possible, but it's clumsy and painful to try to grow into that without having it modeled for us. And so even having it modeled in spirit form by our specific blood lineage ancestors, it's cool, it's something. There's a little bit of repair around that. And for a lot of people, I've guided at least a few thousand people through this work in the last 12, 13 years. And there's been a lot of times, and it's really touching, where people really, like waspy white people, have an emotional heart open breakdown kind of thing, where they're like, oh my God, I had no idea there was anything good in who I am. Like, I had no idea there was actual earth-loving, non-awful beauty in my body and bones and blood. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry that it's been this long before you touched that, and I'm glad you're touching it. And so that having awkward, quietly self-hating waspy white people touch the indigenous ancestral beauty in their pre-Christian European blood, that's good for politics too. It's good for all the cultural healing that we need. Because then is helps people who have inflicted ancestral pain to understand that, to understand that pain in their own families and ancestries, helps them to understand how we get to the point of then inflicting it on others. So yeah, so there's a lot about grief, so respect to that. Well, we're at 9, so we should probably finish up, I suppose. The way it, this year, I'm excited in a good way. I'm busy with teaching. So if you want to try to connect with this work in person, I know for sure this year I'm teaching in Athens, Georgia, Portland, Oregon, Berkeley, California, Moncure, North Carolina, bonus points, if anybody knows where that's at, and Boulder, Colorado. I like teaching in the South, actually. I mean, I don't like it, but I like it. And Minneapolis. I've never been to Minneapolis before, so I'll be there in July, so that'll be good. And then in Rowe, Massachusetts, in Western Mass in September, October. So maybe in Portland, Maine. So, yeah. And I have a book coming out in July through Inner Traditions called Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. So be in touch if you are drawn to this kind of work. I send out a monthly newsletter. I do talks like this. So reach out. And there's a lot of good trainees, all of whom are required to do at least 10 sessions of low income ancestral healing work. So if you know people who, especially, but not only, non-white or otherwise not unusually culturally privileged people who would not otherwise have easy access to this kind of work, but who would enjoy it, there are a bunch of people who I've required to do low-income sessions. So feel free to reach out for that. Thanks, everybody, for your engagement. And yeah, just keep reaching out. Be hopeful. Thanks. Ashe.